to the narrations, so the people knew that they are selected by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. They have the power. And the imams themselves knew that point, that the authenticity comes directly from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. But as you say, it was not enough condition for them, sufficient
exactly.
for them. Is
exactly.
it so?
Exactly, so, that's the point. So let's talk, for example, about Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam is invited by the people of Kufa to go there and to have a government. And although Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam knows about the fact that they may betray him, but the point is that at least apparently, seemingly, people are ready for the Imam to establish a government. Yes. And that is why Imam alayhi salam, accompanied by his companions and close relatives, goes from Mecca to Kufa. So what is the reason? Because apparently the people are showing their willingness and readiness.
Yes.
And Imam is accepting the invitation. But it didn't happen for any other Imam. We do not see in the life of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam or Imam al-Baqir or Imam Sadiq alayhi salam and the rest of the Imams, the fact that, so many people have come to ask them to establish a government. We have some cases in which, for example, a group of the companions of the Imams go to one of the Imams and ask them, why you do not do any uprising? If you do so, you will have so many of us helping you. You can establish a government. And the Imam shows them, in some cases through some miracles, that this is not the case. For example, in one narration, Imam mentions that the number of the people who would be supporting me maybe are less than 10 people or 50 people.
IRIB English Radio presents Questions and Answers on Islamic Beliefs. Answering your theological questions in Questions and Answers on Islamic Beliefs. Send us your questions to EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Now, what is the fruit of the Imam uprising? The fruit and the consequence is that the Imam and these few people who are the closest companions to Imam alayhi salam are all of them going to be martyred and to be killed by the Umayyad Caliphate or the Abbasid Caliphate.
Yes.
So the point is that Islamic rulership is the right of the Imam and no one can take this right from the Imam. But the point is that for this to be realized, one of the conditions is the willingness and readiness of the people. And after the short period of Imam Hassan alayhi salam being in power, the situations were not ready for any of the other Imams to have rulership. And that is why the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam asked the Shia not to take part in any uprising at the time of the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. So the main reason was to save the life of these, pious people.
Yes.
The Imams alayhi salam didn't want their Shia to be killed without any justified reason. It was not the time for the Shia to come and for the Imam of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam to come into the power. This is one point. But the second point is that some people argue that even Imam Ali alayhi salam himself did not claim caliphate. And for example, when we talk about the hadith of Ghadir, in which Imam Ali alayhi salam was appointed by the Holy Prophet as the Imam and Caliph and successor after him, some, especially Wahhabis and Salafis, they claim that Imam Ali alayhi salam himself never considered himself as the true successor after the Holy Prophet. And he never referred to the hadith of Ghadir to claim that I'm the Imam and successor after the Prophet.
Maybe there was a big lesson for the Ummah that time. For 25 years, for example, they selected others as the caliphs, okay? So now, and the whole lifestyle of the Muslims was changed.
Exactly, but the point is
to an extent that Talha and Zubair, when come to Imam Ali alayhi salam, they ask for something that is strange to Imam Ali alayhi salam as the fourth caliph.
But the point is that this is a wrong understanding to claim that Imam Ali alayhi salam never tried for his right and never referred to the story of Ghadir, for example, and the narration of Ghadir. We have many cases mentioned by Sunni scholars. For example, we know that after the second caliph, we have a committee of six people. One of them is Imam Ali alayhi salam, and they were supposed to choose the third caliph.
Yes.
In that meeting, Imam Ali alayhi salam told the other members that, "Is there anyone among you except for me regarding whom the Holy Prophet said, 'Man kunta mawla fa aliyun mawla'? For whomever I'm the guardian, yes. Then after me, Imam Ali alayhi salam is the guardian." So very explicitly, Imam Ali alayhi salam is telling the people that based on the prophetic narration, I'm the caliph over you from the time that the Holy Prophet passed away. This is mentioned in many Sunni sources.
That's right.
And of course, we can refer to Lady Zahra Salamun Alayha. In many cases, Lady Zahra Salamun Alayha told the people that this is the right of Imam Ali alayhi salam, including the famous sermon of Fadakiya. People, our dear listeners, can find this sermon. And the way that Lady Zahra Salamun Alayha proved the imamate and caliphate of Imam Ali alayhi salam. We have the same regarding Imam Hassan alayhi salam, Imam Hussein alayhi salam, and many other companions of the Prophet who prove the fact that the caliphate is belonging to Imam Ali alayhi salam.
The wakala system or deputyship that existed among the main companions of the other infallible imams at the time of Imam al-Sadiq, Imam Musa al-Kazim, Imam al-Reza alayhi salam, these are important too. The system that was so much strong that, for example, could amass wells or wujuhat from here and there to the house and the buyut of the imams, okay, on that time. So this wakala system shows that they had enough power. But as you said, we can say they were also looking for the satisfaction of the people in general and the ummah too.
Of course, that network is for the imams of the Ahlul Bayt to have a kind of connection with the Shia.
Yes.
And not to cut that relation. But it was not enough for the imam to establish a government.
Yes.
Okay, imam is living in Medina, there are some Shia in Iraq, in Iran, and in other parts of the world, and the imams of the Ahlul Bayt, they have this network to take care of the Shia.
Yes.
But does it mean that the number of the Shia, for example, in Medina are enough for Imam to establish a government? Of course not. And the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt have proved this, that the conditions and the situations are not ready for the Imam to establish a government.
Right.
And that is why even, as I mentioned, they asked the Shia not to take part in any uprising, even if it is against the Abbasid Caliph. The Imams, alayhi wasalam, didn't want the Shia to be killed even in an uprising against the Abbasid Caliph because they knew that this is not time for the Shia, for the Imams to establish a government.
That's right.
Coming back to the narrations of Imam Ali alayhi salam, in many narrations Imam Ali alayhi salam calls the people who came to power before him as the people who deserved the caliphate.
Yes.
Which means that from the eyes of Imam Ali alayhi salam, the right of caliphate and governorship belongs to Imam Ali alayhi salam and the progeny of the Prophet, meaning Imam Hassan alayhi salam and the next Imams. This is mentioned just to talk about Nahj al-Balagha in different sermons of Nahj al-Balagha. So my point is that we shouldn't think that Imam alayhi salam has never claimed caliphate and rulership over the Islamic nation after the Holy Prophet.
Right.
No, not only he has mentioned this, he has called people before him as the ones who came into power and usurping the power. For example, we have in the second sermon of Nahj al-Balagha, the Imam talks not only about himself, about all the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt. وَمِنْهَا يَعْنِي آلُ النَّبِيهُمْ مَوْضَعَ السَّرَّ Imam talks about the virtues of the progeny of the Prophet. Because of the shortage of time, I'll just give some references. In the third sermon, Imam Ali Salam also criticizes the caliphs before him and the fact that they usurp the power. The same has been mentioned in the 6 and 73 and 150 sermons of Nahjul Balagha. Our dear listeners can refer to these sermons.
Thank you much, Sheikh. It was very kind of you.
My pleasure.
And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Inna fil jannati nahran min labani aliyin wa husayin wa hasan. لعليٍ وحسينٍ وحسن إن في الجنة نهراً من لبن إن في الجنة نهراً من لبن لعليٍ وحسينٍ وحسن لعليٍ وحسينٍ وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن
يوسف جلالي بتهران
روباشافت غازا
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
In July 2014, Israeli forces waged an all-out war against the Gaza Strip that lasted for 50 days. During the course of the onslaught, Israeli forces killed some 2,200 people, including hundreds of innocent women and children. A further 11,000 were wounded. According to human rights organizations, the Israeli attacks on Palestinians during the 2014 war were systematic and deliberate, with disproportionate and excessive force used against civilians. Rights groups demand that Israeli war criminals be brought to justice.
9 years ago, Israel waged an all-out war in Gaza and committed war crimes. Israel used a tactic of bombing buildings with civilians inside and also attacked United Nations shelters. We have documented the killings and injuring of Palestinian civilians and the mass destruction of civilian infrastructure. We call on international legal bodies, including the International Criminal Court, to investigate the Israeli crimes and to hold the perpetrators accountable.
The 2014 war also saw the bombardment of thousands of homes and the displacement of around 500,000 people. The Israeli regime has consistently failed to make any attempt to hold individuals at any level responsible for the war crimes and crimes against humanity.
I was injured and my 60-year-old son was killed. 3 of my cousins were also killed. My family, along with 10 other families, were hiding in the basement when it was hit by an Israeli rocket.
During the 2014 war, the Israeli regime displayed callous indifference, launching attacks on family homes in the densely populated coastal strip. This is while the United States and other Western countries provided billions of dollars worth of military aid to the Israeli regime during and after the 2014 onslaught on Gaza.
The Israeli regime has shown zero accountability for the crimes perpetrated by its troops due to the protection it enjoys from the international community, especially from the United States. These actions encourage Israel to commit more crimes against the Palestinian people.
Despite Israel's grave violations of international law, Palestinians continue to suffer due to international apathy. Experts say that the Israeli regime has committed acts that amount to war crimes and crimes against humanity in the Gaza Strip since 2008. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
cluster bombs, which the administration of United States President Joe Biden recently classified as a war crime, will now be sent to Ukraine in Washington's latest escalation of the unrest. Cluster munitions are banned by over half the world because they release dozens of bomblets, which often remain unexploded for decades after a conflict has ended. They cause more casualties among civilians than among combatants, and the United States is sending bombs with the imprecise grenades used in the 1991 invasion of Iraq. From bombing irrigation dams in Korea to Agent Orange in Vietnam to using chemical weapons against Iranians, the United States and their Western partners continue to use tactics which the global majority often finds immoral, even during wartime.
These are omnicide weapons. They're the worst atrocities in history, each in a can. Do reduce any sense of our moral authority in this war. Since we're not in this to protect civilians, we're not in this to protect Ukrainians, who we've maneuvered into being our foot soldiers and into dying for American interests while America doesn't sit comfortably at home.
With diplomacy off the table and Kiev's long-awaited counteroffensive a failure, Washington admitted that they are sending the bombs because they are running out of traditional ammunition.
Because of the dramatically high expenditure rates of artillery by Ukraine and by Russia, where we need to build a bridge from where we are today to when we have enough monthly production of unitary rounds. This is the moment to begin the construction of that bridge so that there isn't any period over this summer or heading into this fall when Ukraine is short on artillery.
Escalation is reaching such levels that some analysts in Russia are actually advocating the use of nuclear weapons against Western Europe as the only way to restore the fear of war among Western leaders and to finally end the 9-year conflict in Ukraine. The United States used similar logic against Japan in World War II.
Our government says that stresses that Russia has been using cluster bombs through the war. Russian President Putin is, if anything, unpopular in his country to the extent that he's the most popular politician there. But he gets grief for having gone into Ukraine too soft in an attempt not to kill the civilians that ultimately this civil war has been about. It's been a pogrom by Kiev and by, I think, Ukrainians in the west of the country against its east.
NATO members will meet next week in Lithuania, where many fear an even more significant expansion of the war will be announced. Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
Outside Israel's London embassy, thousands of pro-Palestine protesters vented their anger over Israel's raid in the Jenin refugee camp in occupied Palestine. Speakers condemned not only Israel's crimes, but the ongoing support Britain offers to Tel Aviv.
The horrific footage which is coming out of occupied Palestine by the hour and going viral on social media has sent shockwaves across the globe. These protesters have come out in large numbers here in London to vent their anger and to condemn the British authorities for their so-called complicity in the Israeli crimes against the occupied Palestinian people.
Protest organisers called Israel's assault on the refugee camp barbaric and urged the UK government to abandon plans to outlaw anti-Israel boycott campaigns, including the BDS movement.
It singles out Israel for special treatment, for protection from accountability, which is completely shameful. Why list one country and say, no matter what government is in place, that Israel should not be boycotted? The bill is dangerous on so many fronts. It should never have been brought forward, and it will be shameful if the UK passed this bill.
There is no such right as the right to self-defense for an occupying power. The Palestinian people who have been fighting occupation and fighting for liberation are the ones that have the right to defend themselves. And this is nothing but a justification and a deflection from Israeli perpetual violence against the Palestinians.
Israel and Gaza exchanged fire Wednesday as Israel's regime pulled out from their 2-day raid on the camp. At least 12 Palestinians have been killed, many just teenagers. The Palestinian Red Cross said around 3,000 have been forced to flee their homes to escape the violence. Despite the killings, the UK remains committed to pursuing the anti-BDS bill, making it harder for critics of Israel to support Palestine in Britain. Robert Carter, London.
After decades of activism and art, the collection that has been a lifetime in the making was unveiled. Sandra Wafter's Nakba, Palestinians' Ongoing Dispossession.
I thought it's time to go full circle and try and tap into another form, another method of educating people on the Palestinian flight, because 75 years on, it's still unrelenting, unremitting. As we've seen a couple of days ago in Jenin camp, the onslaughts just carry on relentlessly. And one tries in any way, every way, to shed light on this.
The launch of the collection has come amidst growing tensions in the region. This after a violent Israeli incursion into the Jenin refugee camp, resulting in the killings of yet more Palestinians.
The one key word here is ongoing. The Nakba never, ever ended. It just stops and starts, but there is always strife, there is always oppression, there is always colonizing, there is always land theft. It just does not stop. So I just really look forward to the day when we can have a commemoration of the Nakba, because it would finally mean that it's ended, and this hasn't happened yet.
Wafter's work is visceral and emotive, but the artist wants to impart a message that goes beyond the gallery and into the very corridors of power.
You would think that the authors of Our Dispossession would hold for a minute and reconsider and consider standing on the right side to restitute this problem, this huge catastrophe that they have created. In fact, they are doubling down on shielding Israeli atrocities. It's very shameful, actually. 107 years now since the Balfour Declaration is just ridiculous. Britain has a chance to redress the extreme travesty of justice that it has birthed instead of going the other way and doubling down on shielding war crimes, in effect.
Artists like Sandra Wafter know the value their craft can make in keeping the memories of the Nakba front and centre.
Art is powerful. It can evoke memories of a particular place or a moment in time. It can also be an exemplary tool of resistance. And for artists who are concerned and focused with justice for the Palestinians, well, their message is so important, more important than ever before.
The collection, Nakba, Palestinians' Ongoing Dispossession, is available now. Amina Taylor, London.
As the Israeli regime's biggest attack on Jenin refugee camp in the West Bank fails to weaken the Palestinian resistance factions, solidarity gatherings continue to take place in Lebanon and other parts of the world. Hamas representative in Lebanon has told Press TV that the Palestinian people have taken the decision to resist until the occupied territories are liberated and there is no turning back.
The Palestinian people have made up their mind that they will face the Israeli military machine with all courage and that they will continue until they remove the occupation, not only from the West Bank, but from all of Palestine. What is happening today in Jenin is a smaller version of what is happening on all of Palestine. If this superior military machine of the Israelis is incapable of facing a small refugee camp, then how would it face Gaza or the entire West Bank?
Lebanese people who have gathered in several parts across the country in a show of solidarity with the Palestinians say they have also lived through decades of Israeli aggressions against Lebanon, and they believe that resistance is the sole way to end the occupation, as was the case in Lebanon.
There is no other way to face the Israeli occupation than to continue to resist. The Palestinian people tried all means in order to liberate their land. It was a fiasco. So we need now to consolidate the resistance approach and to have a wider solidarity with this resistance, Palestinian resistance, in the occupied territory.
With the Israeli aggression against the Palestinian, they are trying to do that aggression over and over again. And the Palestinian people, starting from Jenin, trying to liberate first Jenin, but I think it will spread all over Palestine, and probably it will go way abroad.
Jenin camp reflects the real bloody face of the Israeli occupation, the loss of innocent lives, the destruction of homes, the displacement of big families. They are the realities that the Israeli occupation can't ignore anymore. Today we are gathering together in a public space to send a powerful message for the Palestinian people and for the resistance that we are showing our unity and we are showing our position against the violence, injustice, and the silence in the world.
As you enter any refugee camp in Lebanon, you are greeted with posters for martyrs. And refugees there express their unwavering support for resistance fighters inside Palestine.
We are not in solidarity with Jenin. We are one with Jenin. We, the Palestinians in the diaspora and inside Palestine, are one entity, and what is happening inside Jenin is a step towards the liberation of Palestine and a step towards our return to Palestine. What we saw in Jenin gives us hope that liberation is near.
We've become used to their crimes. They bargained that the old generation is gone, but they were stunned how the new generation is even more steadfast and courageous and ready to face them.
After 2 days of Israeli attacks on Jenin, at least 12 Palestinians were killed and dozens more were injured.
The United Nations says it is alarmed at the scale of Israel's assault on Jenin, yet people of Lebanon and Palestine, who have witnessed firsthand decades of Israeli atrocities, say there is nothing alarming about the aggression. However, they all have a collective conviction that the resistance will turn victorious. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Out of the classrooms and under the streets, hundreds of thousands of school teachers here and across England on strike for 48 hours this week in what's become a battle for dignity and better wages.
We want to be with our children. We really do. You know, it's coming towards the end of term. We want to enjoy every day with them. But at the same time, we recognise that the fight for children's future has to involve strike action because this government doesn't listen.
There are others who are listening. Parents and students.
These strikes have to happen. Obviously, they're impacting in the short term, but with extra pay, teachers will be more motivated and they can help in the long run rather than them withering out.
And withering out they are. Underfunded and overworked, the teachers are not just striking, they're leaving the profession. Gillian Keegan, who runs the Department of Education, says the government has made a fair and reasonable pay offer to teachers. Yet her department has refused to publish recommendations for allegedly a higher pay offer by the Independent School Teachers Review Body, a decision that unions say risks dragging out the current dispute.
Part of the argument here is how a pay rise should be paid for. The government says schools should use their existing budgets to fund any pay increases. But the teachers have been pushing back, saying the school budgets are already stretched and that any wage rise should be fully funded by the government.
And it's not just the teachers' unions who aren't being heard. Also, workers across the public sector, such as transport and health, who have supported each other over the months. Solidarity that has scared the government into responding with a set of draconian laws to make it difficult for strikes to take place. In an atmosphere of uncertainty and with inflation still high, the strikers here are defiant, saying they will push ahead with industrial action until their demands are met. Saeed Bourizza, London.
The burning of the Holy Quran in Sweden has ignited a protest in the capital Sana'a, where U.S. and Israeli flags were set on fire in the streets. Protesters also denounced the latest military operations by the Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. Members of the Palestinian-based Islamic Jihad resistance movement also attended the rally. They called on the Muslim world to unite and counter the Israeli occupying forces
We came out to tell the world that we are with Palestinians and with Jenin refugee camp, and we are ready to support them. We in Yemen are ready to go to war with the Israeli enemy, who only seems to understand the language of war and violence.
We came out today to call on the Muslim world to defend the Holy Quran and to support the Palestinian cause, which is the Muslim cause. This is an obligation for Muslims to strive and revive and unite against the enemies of Allah.
Some observers believe Israelis, along with the West, have a hand in promoting those who insult Islam.
The individuals who burned the Holy Quran or who insulted Islam represent the aspirations and stance of the West, which promotes the burning of Quran and protects those who engage in such activities, even on the Eid holiday. This is done just to insult Muslims worldwide. We will no longer stay silent.
Many Yemeni protesters we spoke with expressed their willingness to go to war with the Israeli regime and any state that supports insulting Muslims' holy book or occupying Muslim holy lands.
Israeli officials say the military operations in Jenin aim to strike what they call a terrorist hub in the occupied West Bank city. Now the protesters here say the Muslim world should become united against what they describe the terrorist Israeli regime. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودين.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش، با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد، اینها چیزایی لازم است.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن. از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran. Quran.
کتاب الله.
In the limelight.
Key Democratic lawmakers are openly opposing President Joe Biden over the controversial decision to send cluster munitions to Ukraine. Some experts have even argued that the cluster bombs deal is a clear signal that the war is not going in Ukraine's favor. America is supplying Ukraine with a weapon that is banned by much of the world. Is it worth taking the risk? We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. The website Politico has covered this story and tells us more. Key Democratic lawmakers are breaking with President Joe Biden over the controversial decision to send cluster bombs to Ukraine, arguing that providing the weapons, which are banned by more than 120 countries, cedes the moral high ground and will end up indiscriminately killing civilians. Top Democrats on the House Rules Committee and the panels that fund the Pentagon and the State Department lashed out in rare public statements, broadcasting their break with their party's president. The decision by the Biden administration to transfer cluster munitions to Ukraine is unnecessary and a terrible mistake, said Representative Betty McCollum, Democrat of Minnesota, the ranking member of the House's Defense Appropriations Subcommittee. Representative Betty McCollum said, "The legacy of cluster bombs is misery, death, and expensive cleanup operations generations after their use. These weapons should be eliminated from our stockpiles, not dumped in Ukraine," she said. Cluster bombs, officially called dual-purpose improved conventional munitions, are designed to take out multiple military targets by scattering large numbers of small bomblets over a wide area. They are banned by most NATO countries because the ordnance that fails to explode can end up killing civilians, even long after the conflict has ended. The Democratic lawmakers noted that Congress has barred the transfer of any cluster munition with a dud rate of greater than 1%, though President Biden can waive that rule. Pentagon spokesperson Brigadier General Patrick Ryder said on Thursday, 6th of July, that officials will carefully select only the rounds with lower dud rates, for which there is recent testing, to send to Ukraine. The United States has large numbers of cluster munitions sitting in storage, which officials argue will help Ukraine break through dug-in Russian lines as Kiev is rapidly running out of conventional ammunition. Steel lawmakers joined with arms control advocates this week in saying the Biden administration was making an unacceptable ethical trade-off that would kill civilians in large numbers, alienate allies, and damage the moral case to back Ukraine. Representative Barbara Lee, Democrat of California, the ranking member of the House panel that funds the State Department, tweeted that she was alarmed at the move. While House Rules Committee ranking member Jim McGovern said, while he supports helping Ukraine, sending cluster bombs represents a break with NATO allies, with countries like Britain, France, Germany, and Spain. U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan, on Friday, 7th of July, defended the administration's decision, saying Russia has been using cluster munitions itself. Still, even some more hawkish Democrats ripped the Biden administration. Air Force veteran and House Armed Services member Chrissy Houlihan, in a statement on Friday, 7th of July, said, "All of us must remember that this war will end and the broken pieces of Ukraine will need to be rebuilt. History remembers not only who wins a war, but also how a war is won." Sky News has also covered the same story and tells us more. The White House is fully aware of the huge controversy surrounding the cluster munitions decision. Some 123 countries are part of the 2008 International Convention on Cluster Munitions, which bans the use or transfer of this particular weapon. Almost all of America's allies are signatories to the convention banning cluster munitions. Even within U.S. government circles, there has been deep unease about supplying its own stockpile of cluster munitions to Ukraine. As recently as last week, within the State Department there was division about the decision to supply the weapon. The long and grim record of the cluster bomb explains the unease and the controversy. Globally, civilians represent 97% of cluster munition casualties, according to a report last year by the Landmine and Cluster Munition Monitor, an organization that seeks to ban these weapons altogether. Children are overwhelmingly the victims of cluster bombs. By supplying the weapon, there is a clear risk to civilians, not now necessarily, but in the future. The legacy of unexploded cluster bomblets is evident on former battlefields throughout the globe. The facts on the ground are not in Ukraine's favor. The transfer of cluster munitions is a clear signal that the war is not going well for Ukraine. The so-called spring offensive did not materialize in the spring and looks set to falter throughout the summer. Ukraine is fast running out of more conventional artillery, with supply stocks in America and elsewhere running low. America holds a vast, dormant stockpile of cluster munitions. They could shift the momentum significantly on the ground, wiping out heavily dug-in Russian troops. American officials are accepting that a legacy of civilian casualties is a risk, but counter it by arguing that more civilians are at risk by allowing Russia to win the war. Meanwhile, Britain's Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has said the United Kingdom discourages the use of cluster bombs after the United States agreed to send them to Ukraine. US President Joe Biden has faced criticism for supplying the munitions, which are banned by many allies because of their track record of killing and maiming huge numbers of civilians, particularly children. Britain's Prime Minister Rishi Sunak said the United Kingdom was one of 123 countries that signed a convention banning their use and would continue focusing on supplying tanks and long-range weapons to help the fight against Russia. Cluster bombs detonate in the air and release bomblets that scatter over a large area. Opponents say they kill indiscriminately and that some of the smaller munitions can fail to detonate, posing a long-term risk to civilians. President Biden has called it a difficult decision, but said he had to act as the Ukrainians are fast running out of ammunition. Some human rights groups consider even the use of cluster munitions as a war crime in itself.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the pitch.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamite.
Islamite.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته Dear listeners from all around the world This is You Station again You are listening to IRIB English Radio I am Bita here and with me
And I'm Zainab, her co-host
Yeah, we are here again Our dear, dear home
Yeah, and I have positive vibes coming from Bita right now
Thank
as I'm
you.
Sitting next to her.
That's really nice for me to hear that. How are you doing, Zainab?
Alhamdulillah. How are you, Bita?
It goes well, you know, as usual, the exams and so on. Yeah, I'm just a bit tired. Yeah, it's so soon in the morning, but anyway. So, you know, You told me something really interesting, that you give some, you get some interesting vibes from me and positive vibes. It's exactly the same when we visit some new people. And, you know, when you meet people, there is a kind of first impression that you get from them.
Right.
Do you agree with that? Or?
Of course I do.
Yeah, you know, because there are some people, they want to act really honest and they're like, no, no, we don't judge people at first sight. But it's not like that, you know. Everybody gets some kind of special vibe.
Right, exactly. I do get.
Ew, thank you for being so frank. So, what do you think are the reasons these vibes we get at first sight?
Well, I think maybe we find the people. Let's talk about those if we get positive vibes.
Yeah.
Let's start with the positive ones. I think we get positive vibes from people who we find, like, you know, are kind of similar to us in one or the other way. Like, they are having same kind of interests you know, values or kind of personality or some other traits. We feel kind of comfortable. That's some, you know, a different feeling of being in a comfort zone with
Similarities, of course, for sure. It's something really... When you have something in common with other people, it feels like you are comfortable talking to them and so on. I do agree with what you're telling me, but sometimes I get the positive vibe from the people that I have no similarities at all with them.
Exactly.
So what do you think about these cases?
Exactly. I mean, talking about you yourself, I have not known you before, but I met you for the first time on radio, and... I was like, it was not that kind of, you know, the girls really don't get positive vibes always from other girls whom they don't know at the very first sight, but it was a different one. I was like some kind of personality sitting next to you, you know.
Thank you.
Maybe I was because of being kind or respectful, the way you were respectful or... You know, genuine kind of person sitting next to you. So it was like,
come on.
No, not. I'm saying there are some things like, you know, you don't show, you can't show off, you know, kindness and respect all the time. That was like, you pick up, the other person picks up.
I get it.
These things, yeah.
You know, so let's have the negative sides too.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Because I think the most part and the most impression we get from other people is negative, mostly. Yeah, we have to tell that.
Especially when a girl sees another girl.
Yeah, exactly. When they are the same gender, it feels like there is a kind of guard towards each other.
Right.
And yeah, they want to show off everything and they want to be better and superior. And I think this is the first and underlying reason that we feel negative.
Right.
And, you know, let's get this negative part and go for a short break. Then we're going to come
back. Exactly. So stay tuned, dear listeners. We'll be back in a while.
You station again. I'm Vita and Zainab here with me.
Yes, I'm Zainab with Vita, enjoying positive vibes from her. But we're talking about the negative vibes and the first impression.
Yeah, exactly. We're talking about the first impression, especially the negative side of that,
right?
Which is mostly more common than the other part. And you know, I think there could be many, many things that will lead to your negative vibe from someone. The first thing is appearance, in my opinion. And the most and the underlying reason of the vibe, the first vibe we get from other people, is their appearance, for
exactly.
sure. You know, sometimes, you know, there is some difference between you and the other people, especially girls, that they have different kinds of, I don't know, hijab and so on. And when you meet someone who is different.
Who is rude, who is like, has kind of attitude or nothing.
Yeah, I don't know. But it's kind of a presupposition or presumption that you have from other people by their appearance. I don't know whether it is true or not, but I think it has its own effects. You cannot ignore it. You cannot tell me that, no, appearance has nothing to do with
appearance
my personality.
Appearance has got a lot to do with it.
Exactly.
Appearance says a lot about the negative vibes because, yes, appearance in itself. Like even like it's not just about the clothes. The smile you wear on your face or the
body language
on you. Yeah, exactly. Your body language speaks a lot about your character, your personality, what kind of personality you are. And that exactly gives the energy, the vibes to the opposite person.
Exactly. And I think this body language really matters, especially eye contact.
Right.
At first impression and at first sight, the only thing that catch your attention is the eye contact that you are having with someone. And there are some people who are really shy and introvert.
Right.
And I think these people have some kind of negative vibe at first sight.
Exactly.
Do you agree with that? I don't know whether it is because they are introvert, they cannot show themselves
much. If you're the opposite, definitely you don't have the positive vibes. Because, like, see, if you're meeting an introvert person and you yourself are an extrovert.
Yeah.
You are not comfortable.
Yeah.
You don't find yourself in a comfort zone. Like, you find that she's not my cup of tea.
So what if you are an introvert and you are visiting an introvert person? Again?
You have positive vibes, then maybe.
Maybe. It's a bit complicated. Maybe,
but mostly we have known that like pulls do repel. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Baby here again, but I think it's even also depends on the speech, you know, the communication you have. For example, if you find some person, that person is insecure or talks pessimistic things, you know, you kind of really don't get positive vibes from that person.
Yeah.
It's likely to get negative vibes from the person who's not an optimistic thinker.
So let's give a list of all these factors that we talked about up to here. You know, we talked about similarity, which is one of the most important reasons.
Right.
I don't know, periods, being an extrovert or introvert. And also, there is another thing which I want to add to this list, which is self-confidence.
Exactly. I wanted to add that too.
Yeah. Self-confidence really, really matters in everyday communication.
Right.
And I think self-confident people have healthier communication with other people.
Exactly. The people who are optimistic, confident, enthusiastic, you do get those positive vibes from them. And if there's not, there's a difference.
So I think we're running out of time. We have to go for a break right now.
Right.
Stay tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
So, dear listeners, this is Youth Station at your service, and we're talking about something really controversial at the same time interesting. The first impression you get from other people. We counted some factors and features up to here, but let's make it more personal. Do you give a negative or positive vibe yourself? What
do
you
think? To myself?
Yeah, to other people at first sight.
To other people? Of course I might be giving, but I don't know to whom I give positives, to whom I give negatives.
So it depends, I think.
Right, exactly.
It depends on the people you are meeting. I mean, isn't something really internal and personal?
Well, I think I give, if I talk about negative vibes, I may give vibes to someone who does not have my kind of interest. I know they were my own cousins who made a group, a family group on the WhatsApp.
Yeah.
And they didn't add me there. And once we were in a family and they were saying, hey, that joke was amazing in that particular group and all. I was like, which group?
Oh, my gosh.
And all these cousins of mine told me, you're not in that group? Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, we forgot.
Yeah.
And then I get to know that they don't want to add me because they don't want to get restricted. Because, like, they feel like she's elder sister. She'll be restricting us from don't do this, don't cross lines, don't do,
teaching
us discipline. So sometimes when you have kind of people, she will rule me, you don't have positive vibes and you don't want to be connected to them all the time.
Yeah,
so.
I get that. There's, you know, but I think even age here matters a lot, you know?
Exactly. So I just was telling you that I had this age difference with my cousins. They were all young and I was elder to them. And as an elder sister, I would
You are the rule, mother. model. You're the role model and they have to obey you, so they don't want you there. This is sad. Oh my gosh. You know, I'm not, I think when you see, I don't know, so much older people, old women, men, it feels like they are so apart from you, you know?
Right.
You feel a kind of detachment from these persons. And also there is this feeling that I don't want to be like them one day.
Right.
Being old is something that you cannot accept easily,
right.
You know? And because of that, I think there is this gap between the young generation, especially that we're talking in your station.
Exactly.
Yeah, there is this gap between these people. And because of that, the first impression we get from older people is always like that they are going to control us. They're going to tell us what to do, what not to do.
Exactly.
And yeah, this is going to lead to kind of negative
free,
vibe.
You want to live in your own world. You want to have your... You want to explore, basically.
I want to be a rebel.
Everyone you feel like is not... is coming in my way to, you know... to stop me from exploring.
Yeah. I know what you mean.
Yeah.
So, and you mentioned something really interesting that I want to come up again with that idea, which was you told me when a girl met a girl for the first time, there is more and I get more of a negative vibe.
Yeah.
Why do you think
experienced
so?
That?
Yeah, I have experienced it, but I don't know the main reason.
Well, I think there's always this, there could be this reason that I am better than her.
Yeah,
and girls have
superiority.
Always this kind of mentality that I want to be someone, I should be looking more attractive. I should be, I want to be someone who is easily picked up from the crowd. But if I am missed because of someone else, I can accept that.
Is it the same for men too, or... They're different.
Men are different, probably.
Oh, my gosh. You know, because they are carefree and easygoing, I think. They don't care about these details.
Exactly.
Yeah, that women just pay too much attention, I have to tell that, to these sort of things. And they are comfortable with each other. And I think because men don't pay attention to details so much, it's really easier for them not to give a vibe at a first sight.
So, yeah, I think... It differs from men to women, and also you know.
Yeah, we're not going to generalize anything.
Exactly. This is... Also, I think from different cultures.
Yeah.
When you meet people from different cultures, when you meet people from different backgrounds, you may have maybe
and this
that,
background is really important too.
Exactly. You may have that first vibe because of the background, because of that particular background they come from. Or the particular culture they come from, not having, you know, necessarily something with that person. But I think, hey, this is not good to have a very negative vibe at the very first impression. You don't know the person exactly. It's okay to have vibes, but we can manage them probably. Like, I think we should try to dwell in positive things. We should try to focus on the positives. We should, because when we are just looking for the negatives in the opposite person, we'll only get negative vibes. So rather than just focusing on them, I think we should shift our attention to the positives of that person, because every person has some good quality, right? For sure. So we should try to focus our attention on those positives so that we get, you know, a positive. We can also try to find that positive vibe from that person.
So to wrap the things up, we counted so many features for the first impression we get from other people. And, you know, I think there are many exceptions too. For example, you, dear listeners here, you, despite the fact that you're not present here at the studio, we get your beautiful positive vibe.
Exactly.
And it is helping us here. And it is our energy and inspiration for going on in this studio. So thank you for listening to us. I think it was all the time we had for today's episode.
Right. Until another session, we bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. A IRIB English Radio.